lobbyists, but Mark Hanna had strongly urged the meeting, and after Walla Walla, he wanted to be accommodating. The glossy little lawyer had made himself indispensable in all canal matters, darting with bright-eyed, bumblebee quickness among every possible source of pollen. Cromwell had spies in Bogota, paid agents in Cologne and Panama City, political supporters in Washington, and financial backers in Paris and New York. Every infusion of news, every fresh pledge of funds, was more honey in his hive. Roosevelt's stiff petals yielded to his fervor. For a half hour before lunch, and 2 hours that afternoon, they went over every aspect of the canal situation. Cromwell thought that President Maroquin favored the treaty, but did not have enough political strength to oppose the will of the Colombian Congress. If Maroquin recommended ratification, there might be a coup by anti-treaty forces. If he advised against, he risked the secession of Panama. Roosevelt told Cromwell that he was determined to build a Panama Canal and would tolerate no trickery by Colombia. If the treaty was rejected and Panama seceded, he would strongly favor dealing with the new republic. This was all the lobbyist needed to hear. He walked out into the fresh June evening. White sails crept down the Potomac. Somewhere a baseball crowd was roaring. Washington had shut for the summer. Only its insatiable press corps lingered. Cromwell felt that pleasant loosening of the lips known to all executive office visitors, particularly those who think they have prevailed on the president. Full as he was of news, he did not dare to leak it directly. Instead, he briefed an aide who had close connections to the New York world. Overnight, an uncannily prophetic article ground out of the Pulitzer Press. New Republic may arise to grant canal. The state of Panama ready to secede if the treaty is rejected by the Colombian Congress. Roosevelt is said to encourage the idea. Washington, June 13. President Roosevelt is determined to have the Panama Canal route. He has no intention of beginning negotiations for the Nicaragua route. The view of the president is known to be that as the United States has spent millions of dollars in ascertaining which route is most feasible, as three different ministers from Colombia have declared their government willing to grant every concession for the construction of a canal, and as two treaties have been signed granting rights of way across the Isthmus of Panama, it would be unfair to the United States if the best route be not obtained. Advices received here daily indicate great opposition to the canal treaty at Bogota. Its defeat seems probable. Information has also reached this city that the state of Panama, which embraces all the proposed canal zone, stands ready to secede from Colombia and enter into a canal treaty with the United States, giving this government the equivalent of absolute sovereignty over the canal zone. The city of Panama alone will be exempted. In return, the President of the United States should promptly recognize the new government when established and at once appoint a minister to negotiate and sign a canal treaty. The article went on to report that Roosevelt's cabinet fully supported his plan, as did congressional leaders. Apparently, the President was prepared to wait a reasonable time for ratification of the treaty, but if there was any hint of deliberate delay, he would quickly make the above plan operable. One detail missing from the article was Cromwell's private prediction that the Panamanian Revolution would occur on the third day of November. Roosevelt issued no denial of the World article, nor of similar scenarios in the Washington Evening Star and New York Sun. He was known to be a quick repudiator of his own faux pas, so evidently he was sending Bogota a message. Iran sent one, too, also predicting that Panama might secede. Cromwell, for his part, smoothly assured reporters that he still expected ratification. On 15 June, six solemn gentlemen waited on the president: Leo N. Levi, Jacob Firth, Solomon Sulzberger, Joseph D. Coons, Adolph Moses, and Simon Wolfe. They were escorted by John Hay, courteously veiling his usual jocular anti-Semitism. The Hebrews, poor dears. One could not mock their present distress. All over America, Christians as well as Jews were collecting funds to help the surviving victims of the Kishinev pogrom. 10,000 refugees were still homeless, and an equal number dependent on relief. Roosevelt wanted to contribute $100. "Would it do any good for me to say a word in behalf of the Jews?" he asked Hay en route before receiving the delegation. "Or would it do harm?" He knew the answer in advance. They objected even to his sending money, on grounds of diplomatic propriety. "I suppose," Roosevelt conceded, "it would be very much like the Tsar spreading his horror of our lynching Negroes." Hay tried to explain to the delegation, representing the Executive Committee of B'nai B'rith, that there were only two motives that might justify administration criticism of Russia's domestic policy. The first was national self-interest, and the second, hardly imaginable, an expressed willingness in St. Petersburg to listen. What possible advantage would it be to the United States, and what possible advantage to the Jews of Russia, if we should make a protest against these fiendish cruelties and be told that it was none of our business? Leo Levi, the group's spokesman, awkwardly addressed himself to the first consideration. He said that it was indeed in the national interest to prevent a diaspora of persecuted Russian Jews to America. The anti-Tsarist propaganda such immigrants would bring with them was sure to undermine amity between Russia and the United States. Something must be done to allay the fears of the Jews in Russia and thus stem their rush to this country. Having thus expressed the traditional disdain of Western for Eastern Jews, Levi went on to read a petition to Nicholas II, the language of which was enough to make Hay blanch. It spoke of horror and reprobation around the world at the carnage in Kishinev, accused Russian authorities of tolerating ignorance, superstition, and bigotry, and concluded, "Religious persecution is more sinful and more fatuous even than war." Hay responded first in unctuous but negative tones. He said that the United States deplored all acts of cruelty and injustice, but had to carefully consider whether she had any right to question the internal affairs of another sovereign power. The Tsar, in any case, was an enlightened sovereign who would surely never permit another Kishinev. Roosevelt spoke much more sympathetically. "I have never in my experience in this country known of a more immediate or a deeper expression of sympathy," he said. It was natural that the United States, with her large Jewish population, should have the most intense and widespread reaction against the pogrom. He recited some lines from Longfellow's The Jewish Cemetery at Newport, and paid tribute to the American Jews who had fought in the Revolution and Civil War. Inevitably, mention of the word war reminded him of his charge up San Juan Hill. "When I was myself in the army, one of the best colonels among the regular regiments who did so well on that day, who fought beside me, was a Jew." As regimental commander, he had personally promoted 5 men, 2 Protestants, 2 Catholics, and 1 Jew. Ingenuous protests like this, half boyish, half calculating, always made Hay's whiskers twitch, but the committee listened with respect. Soon Roosevelt was well away. "You may possibly recall, I am certain some of my New York friends will recall, that during the time I was police commissioner, a man came from abroad, I am sorry to say a clergyman, to start an anti-Jewish agitation in New York, and announced his intention of holding meetings to assail the Jews. The matter was brought to my attention. Of course, I had no power to prevent these meetings. After a good deal of thought, I detailed a Jewish sergeant and 40 Jew policemen to protect the agitator while he held his meetings. So he made his speeches denouncing the Jews, protected exclusively by Jews." It was a story he loved to tell. "Now let me give you another little example." After an hour of such confidences, the committee trooped out, glowing with satisfaction. Questioned by reporters, they had to admit that they had failed in their mission. However, the president had promised to read the petition most carefully. His Excellency Arturo Paul Nicholas, Count de Cassini and Marquis de Capizucci de Bologna, Russian Ambassador Extraordinary and Minister Plenipotentiary to the United States, told Roosevelt that some 400 anti-Semitic rioters had been arrested in Kishinev and the local governor dismissed for failing to prevent the pogrom. Hay cautioned that Cassini could not be trusted. For all his Italian nomenclature, he was as Russian as borscht, and lied with fabled virtuosity. The ambassador, who mysteriously depended on his teenage daughter, Marguerite, for social purposes, introduced her around town as Princess Cassini, when she was neither a princess nor, according to rumor, a Cassini. His numberless jeweled decorations may not all have been earned in the Tsar's service, but they were the glittering envy of Embassy Row. When he stood under a chandelier at receptions, he looked like a section of the Milky Way. Cassini's assurances regarding Kishinev were nothing compared to his obfuscations about when, if ever, Russia intended to withdraw from Manchuria. He would say only that the ports there were now open to United States trade. This came as news to American observers in China, who reported that the Russian bear had also begun to prowl Korea. Dealing with a government with whom mendacity is a science is an extremely difficult matter, Hay complained. Roosevelt cared little for Korea, a little impotent kingdom that fancied itself an empire, and even less for China, but he was aware that the latter was potentially the world's greatest market. If the open door was not so blocked by Russia, the United States could easily export everything the Chinese wanted to buy. We wish for our people the commercial privileges which Russia, again and again, has said we shall have, Roosevelt wrote to Lyman Abbott, the editor of Outlook. It is very irritating. I do not know what action may be necessary in the future. As a strategic pragmatist, he felt that Russia had some legitimate aspirations to fulfill in Manchuria, providing China was not partitioned and the Far Eastern balance of power maintained. He agreed with Frederick W. Hals, one of his private foreign policy advisers, who had written, "You cannot keep an empire of 120 million away from a harbor, Port Arthur, which is not frozen up in winter. No empire would build a stupendous work like the Siberian Railroad to end anywhere but in an ice-free harbor under its own control." Cassini expressed the same thought to his daughter in the privacy of the Russian embassy. "Try to understand this, Margot," he said, running a long forefinger down the map of Manchuria to Port Arthur. "To possess the east, Russia must possess the Liaodong Peninsula." Roosevelt put aside his foreign policy troubles on the new White House tennis court. He played with intense concentration, quite unaware of the strangeness of his style. When serving, he grasped the racket stem halfway, forefinger pointing upward. His myopia kept him close to the net, but his reflexes were so quick that he nevertheless covered the court well, chasing the balls that got past him. After smashing a winning shot, he would rejoice with falsetto shrieks and hop around on one foot, singing and laughing. Washington tour guides began driving their vehicles down West Executive Avenue with megaphoned commentary. "To the left you will see the famous tennis court. On most any pleasant afternoon you may see the president there reaching for a high ball." Roosevelt's favorite opponents were Gifford Pinchot and James Garfield. Although they were younger and more lithe than he could manage three sets with either of them. Speck von Sternberg, his old partner from Civil Service Commission days, still played a decent game, and Henry Cabot Lodge returned serves from all positions, consonant with senatorial dignity. But the season's real surprise was Jules Jusserand, looking not unlike a Mont Blanc chamois, with his pointy beard and neat, precise leaps. The little ambassador darted about as nimbly as he ranged the field of medieval literature. Roosevelt beamed at him with increasing favor, much to the envy of Count Cassini, who received no invitations. On 22 June, the President received a letter from his first Southern appointee, Judge Thomas G. Jones of Alabama. He was pleased to read that Jones had, true to Booker T. Washington's recommendation, condemned peonage as the modern equivalent of slavery, and sentenced several white racists to prison for holding black employees against their wills. Roosevelt sent a copy to Lyman Abbott, his most consistently reliable editorial supporter. "Unfortunately," he wrote, "there is in the South a very large element which hates and despises the Negro, but is bent upon his continuing in the land." The element was larger than he thought, and not confined to the South. 100 miles northeast of the White House that evening, quiet groups of white men began to collect around a penitentiary near Wilmington, Delaware. The building was a massive structure, representing the latest in prison engineering. Wilmington's police chief, whose name was Black, had chosen it to shelter a Negro murder suspect, whose name was White. Black felt that White needed all the security he could get, because the murder victim, who had identified him before dying, was a white teenage girl. White sat now, deep within the penitentiary, in a steel cell, in a steel gallery, in a steel chamber, sheathed behind brick walls, each with its own steel door, then a thicker wall with a bigger door of wood and steel, then a yard, then another brick wall, and the biggest door of all, beyond which the quiet groups were forming. Daylight faded. Still more quiet men came from the city and from the fields, until there were no spaces left between the groups waiting for dark. The communal mood was disciplined, almost professional. Marksmen checked their rifles. Boilermakers armed themselves with freshly sharpened saws and cold steel chisels. Quarriers counted out sticks of dynamite. Shipyard workers readied a huge launch ram. At sunset, electric lights went on in the yard. The marksmen took aim. Quickly, methodically, every bulb was shot out. Inside, the warden took his wife and children upstairs and locked them in the women's chamber. Chief Black and two deputies arrived, stood against the yard door, and pleaded that the law be allowed to take its course. A short man in a red sweater listened, smiling, then said, "Come on, boys, get to one side. You're bothering us." Out of the darkness came the ram, and the big door split like balsa. The crowd, 4,000 strong now, surged roaring into the yard. Guards on the penitentiary roof fired high. There was an answering fusillade, so heavy that the guards dropped out of sight. The boilermakers came forward and began to saw through the door of wood and steel bars. In 20 minutes, it was down. Beyond lay a door of solid steel. That took a half hour. The crowd waited patiently. A flight of stairs led down to yet another steel door. The boilermakers took new saws and cold chisels and set to work. Prison staff inside pushed a fire hose through the door's speaking hatch and shot out a high-pressure blast. This momentarily delayed progress, but the marksmen fired bullets down the hose until its handlers withdrew. Soon the door was open. Tunnel-like passages receded in several directions. The mob explored them and reported back to the man in the red sweater. Attention focused on a third door of solid steel. The boilermakers crouched down again. By then, the rumble of thousands of voices and the steady rasp of sawing must have penetrated to the inmates, who had not heard the initial tumult in the yard. Most were Negroes. By the time the third door fell and the mob entered the prison chamber, they were hysterical with fear. "He's in cell 13," one man screamed, "on the second gallery." That meant two more barriers of steel. Afterwards, when experts came to assess the damage, they had nothing but praise for the skill of the boilermakers. Every plate, bar, and bolt was sliced as smoothly as cheddar. The last filament snapped at 11 p.m., and cell 13 revealed itself. It was empty. There was a moment's hesitation. Then, shove back the panel. Hard as it was to believe that a 6-foot Negro could squeeze himself into a shallow closet measuring 4 feet by 2.5 feet, when the door slid open, White burst out like a bull. Vice-like hands secured him. Then, as joyful shouts echoed through the passages into the yard, the prisoner was escorted outside. "I did it," White jabbered in half-praying, half-confessional tones. "O Christ, save my soul, I did it." His mantra continued non-stop, even when the man in the red sweater calmed the waiting crowd. "Let nobody strike or hurt him. We are going to take him to the place where he committed the crime, and we are going to burn him alive." An oddly ecclesiastical procession began. A man on a white horse rode his mount in slow circles to clear the way. Next came an old farmer in blue overalls, carrying a lantern on a long forked stick. Then came White, weaving as if drunk between his two escorts. 6 other horsemen flanked him, and the crowd fell into place behind. As the procession moved out into open country along a mud road pleached with maple trees, its joy increased. Someone struck up, "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight," to roars of laughter. Then massed voices joined in, "Marching through Georgia." Young men jumped through the trees and fanned out across the fields, but they stayed abreast of the swaying lantern and the white horse. Around midnight, the scene of White's crime came into view, a notched hedge by a plowed field. He stood talking to himself as carpenters cut fence rails into faggots. A youth in a Panama hat chopped slats into kindling. Soon a neat pyre arose, its interstices stuffed with straw. Ceaselessly moving, the man on the white horse shaped the crowd into a circle and ordered the inner ring to hold hands. Centripetal pressure made the ring wreathe and sway. Oddly, those nearest the pyre seemed disposed to kick it down. "For God's sake," a voice called, "don't do this. Shoot the man. Hang him. Don't burn him." The man in the red sweater shouted, "We're going to burn the nigger alive, and we're going to do it right here and now." He produced a rope. White was brought inside the ring and bound from the ankles up like a papoose. His confession moaned on. "Then I gave her a hack in the throat with my knife and asked her again." The rope began to cramp his chest. "You would not do this to me if I was a white man." A few more coils silenced him. It was 1:30 in the morning. Suddenly, White was seized at head and foot and tossed onto the pyre. A match lit the straw. "Give it to him. Burn him up." The yells sounded scattered and uncertain. Then flames climbed over White's body. Several watchers turned away, gagging. Some of the Negro's bonds burned loose, and he managed to writhe off the pyre, screaming, "O God, forgive me." He was tossed back, head foremost, and the fire, fierce now, engulfed him. Incredibly, White writhed off again. Before he could be picked up, an exasperated bystander hoisted a long-handled hammer, arched it through the air, and shattered his skull. "That settles it." There was a chorus of disappointment from the incendiarists, led by the old farmer with the lantern. They returned the corpse to the pyre, which burned all night. By dawn, a few pale bones were all that remained of the black man, White. Vendors hawked them in the streets of Wilmington as souvenirs. Chapter 17. No Color of Right. "I'll tell ye, 'tis a great mistake to think that anyone really wants to reform." The Delaware lynching was not, as some shocked headlines claimed, the first to occur north of the Mason-Dixon line, but it was the first there with a motive that was explicitly racial, and its sadism revolted even Southerners. Roosevelt, child of a Georgian mother, was torn in his heart between the horror that such savagery aroused and concern that if he spoke out against it now, as passions still surged. Fresh mobs were roaming the streets of Wilmington, protesting Sheriff Black's arrest of the man in the red shirt. he might touch off worse and wider demonstrations. His one public reference to lynching, in front of the Custis Lee mansion, had badly damaged him politically. There was no question he must say something soon. But when, and how best for moral effect? He poured out his distress to Jules Jusserand, who was fast becoming a confidant. What really worried him, he said, was the demoralizing effect of mob executions on young minds. He had heard of boys of 12 taking part. They will be brutalized for life. The Delaware affair came as a particular shock to Roosevelt because the national lynch rate had been dropping since he had taken office. If now 4,000 hitherto peaceful whites living on Union soil were capable of such barbarity, what price Judge Jones's manumission of a few peons in the South? As summer settled down over Washington, the president, deserted by his wife and children, waited impatiently for some positive news from Bogota. On 24 June, he gave a bachelor dinner for Hay and Jusserand. He said he was studying the war reports of Prince Eugene of Savoy, that most self-confident and impetuous of monarchs, and was not fazed by James J. Hill's angry determination to take the Northern Securities case to the Supreme Court. "He detests me, but I admire him," Roosevelt said. "He will detest me much more before I have done with him." Hay, much of whose wealth derived from railroad stocks, disapproved of the administration's antitrust policy. "Where will it begin and where will it stop?" he complained to Jusserand afterward. "Where is the limit, the line of demarcation?" The next morning, a cable arrived from Arthur Beaupré, saying that the Colombian Congress had at last convened to debate the treaty, but did not appear to be intimidated by Hay's ultimatum. A good sign, perhaps, was that President Marroquin had not specifically recommended against ratification. That guaranteed many weeks, if not months, of leisurely debate. Hay and Roosevelt agreed to await further developments in their respective watering places. With that, they separately left town. Assistant Secretary of State Francis B. Loomis remained behind to stay in wire contact with Beaupré. "Out of consideration for my feelings," the president advised Hay, "pray go as little to Washington this summer as possible. Otherwise I shall feel too poignantly that I am neglecting my own duty." Cannons crashed, and a school choir sang, "God Save the President," when Roosevelt stepped down under the white gull wings of Oyster Bay Station on 27 June 1903. He listened, smiling, his hand resting on a child's small golden head, the face beneath suffused in bliss. His own children stood outside the circle of attention, waiting to escort him to his carriage. They felt no sense of deprivation, for when he gave without stint. Only Alice, still the family orphan at 19, yearned for more. Haunted by the ghost of her namesake, hurt by his denial of that ghost, contemptuous of his guilt, she fought the maddening smile as best she could, with her own income, with cigarettes and flashy clothes. She begged him to let her buy a red automobile, like Marguerite Cassini's. Rebuffed, she chauffeured the cars of other friends at desperate speeds up to 25 miles an hour. She kept dynamite caps and pet reptiles in her purse, stuck silver butterflies in her hair, and, knowing how Roosevelt despised arrogant wealth, flaunted her popularity with the 400. But she remained his blessed girl. It was also what he called doughty little Ethel. "Father doesn't care for me," Alice scratched angrily in her diary. "That is to say, 1/8 as much as he does for the other children. We are not in the least congenial. Why should he pay any attention to me or things that I live for, except to look upon them with disapproval?" The most Roosevelt would say to Ted was, "I wish she had some pronounced serious taste." Ted, now 15, understood the word serious very well. He had all of his father's purposeful force, but imagination and intellect were denied him. Small, nervous, grim, plug-ugly, he made plenty of the best blood flow at Groton. "He is a regular bull terrier," Roosevelt noted proudly. In a game last year, he broke his collarbone, but finished the game without letting anyone know what had happened. Kermit, 13, was a grave, fine-eyed, clumsy adolescent whom Edith adored. Kermit, 13, was a grave, fine-eyed, clumsy adolescent whom Edith adored. Roosevelt was aware of a solitariness and bookishness, not unlike his own in youth, but Kermit also had a yielding quality, if not exactly soft. He seems to hold his own well with boys. He was pliable and easy to bruise. Ethel, nearly 12, was already the family housefrau, a heavy-legged, blunt-featured girl who bossed the servants and took no nonsense from horses. Roosevelt thought her gloomy, but she was in reality shy, intimidated both by his power and by her half-sister's glamour. The two smallest boys, aged 9 and 5, were still too much in a state of perpetual motion, on banisters, bicycles, ponies, stilts, or swaying trees, to register on anyone with precise definition. Out of the noisy scurry that was Archie, there poked occasionally a fierce, hawk-like face and sharp, bony extremities, much bitten by Josiah the Badger. When the dust clouds around Quentin thinned, a miniature Theodore Roosevelt was revealed, dome-headed and weaselly garrulous, with mild, rather abstracted blue eyes. "Washington is now quite deserted," Speck von Sternberg noted at the end of June, "and the men who are pushing the world seem to be taking a short and well-deserved nap." One of the pushiest, however, remained in town long enough to disturb the rest of both President and Secretary of State. "The Russian government," Count Cassini announced on 1 July, "most positively and absolutely denies the reports that it has offered any official explanations to the American government regarding the Kishinev incident." Roosevelt was mystified. No explanation had been demanded. He and Hay had decided, on second thought, to allow the B'nai B'rith leaders to proceed with their petition on the understanding that it was non-governmental and almost certainly a waste of ink. Cassini confirmed the latter point. "The Russian government has categorically refused to receive any petitions, communications, or representations from any power regarding Russian internal affairs." Behind this statement, Roosevelt sensed shame over the pogrom, as well as fear of publicity that might further hurt Russian prestige, already damaged by the occupation of Manchuria. He saw how he might exploit the Tsar's embarrassment to his own advantage, winning the gratitude both of Jews and of American exporters hungry for Far Eastern trade. A peremptory telegram went forth from Oyster Bay to Acting Secretary of State Loomis, ordering him, in the absence of Secretary Hay, to respond publicly to Cassini's statement. He must express the deep sympathy felt not only by the administration, but by all the American people for the unfortunate Jews who have been the victims of the recent appalling massacres and outrages. Loomis was further authorized to quote another official as saying, in tones recognizably Rooseveltian, that it seemed somewhat strange, to say the least, for the Russian government to make such a statement at such a time, when, by methods which are currently the reverse of friendly to the United States, it has sought to make China join in breaking the plighted faith of all the powers as to the open door in Manchuria. Throwing all semblance of impartiality aside, Roosevelt urged Loomis to expedite the Jewish petition, still gathering signatures, and prepare it for immediate transmission to St. Petersburg. Cassini was about to sail home on vacation. Russia must feel America's displeasure before he arrived and smoothed things over. John Hay, unaware of what was going on, wrote Roosevelt to say that Cassini's extraordinary statement reinforced his earlier doubts about the petition. Better simply for B'nai B'rith to publicize its rejection in advance. We can then all of us say what we think proper, and Russia cannot complain of anything we say among ourselves." His letter came too late to influence the telegrams and telephone calls buzzing back and forth between the summer White House and Washington. Whether Hay liked it or not, Roosevelt was beginning to act more and more as his own Secretary of State. A day or two later, Hay received a summons to Sagamore Hill, amid rumors that he would soon resign. It was assumed, correctly, that he felt the United States was becoming too confrontational in its foreign policy, not only vis-à-vis Russia and Germany, but also toward Canada and Great Britain in the Alaska boundary dispute. Roosevelt's three impartial jurists, Elihu Root, Henry Cabot Lodge, and former Senator George Turner, were busy polishing their prejudices for an upcoming tribunal in London. Hay was not so much disenchanted as weary of the strain of working for Theodore the Sudden. He packed his bags, wondering if this was to be the first of many summer interruptions. McKinley had never called for him without reason. Roosevelt tended to call first and think of reasons afterward. "I always find T.R. engaged with a dozen other people, and it is an hour's wait and a minute's talk, and a certainty that there was no necessity of my coming at all." Sure enough, when he rolled under the porte-cochere on 7 July, the president was entertaining three senators, a Quaker financier, a poet, and a playboy. "Will you excuse me till I play a game of tennis with Winty Chandler? I have had no exercise all day." Hay went off for a stroll around the estate and did not see Roosevelt again that afternoon. In spite of himself, he was charmed by Sagamore Hill. He admired its high panorama of trees and water, no other houses visible in any direction, and liked its air of dignified simplicity. At 6 o'clock, out of long habit, he dressed in black tie for dinner and noticed that Roosevelt did the same. "The president was so cordial and hospitable," he wrote his wife, "that I felt ashamed of my surly crossness at having to go there." When they did have their discussion, over coffee on the porch, it was long and businesslike. Hay abandoned all thought of resignation. Aside from Manchuria and the Kishinev petition, there were encouraging developments in Bogota. President Marroquin had privately begun to pressure the Colombian Congress to ratify the Panama Canal Treaty. Members of the lower chamber were reported to be in favor. Senate opposition was still stiff, but if Marroquin was as powerful as Beaupré believed, the treaty might yet prevail, and Panamanians withdraw their threat of secession. President and secretary talked far into the night, while their imagined world ordered itself pleasingly, obediently, beyond the twinkling horizons of Oyster Bay. Hay said goodbye the next morning, then continued south to Washington. His surprise arrival in the broiling city served notice to both Loomis and Roosevelt that he was still boss of the State Department and would monitor all their future communications. Yet he could not forget the latter's graciousness at Sagamore Hill. "It is a comfort to work for a president who, besides being a lot of other things, happened to be born a gentleman." On 12 July, a sobering cable arrived from Arthur Beaupré. He reported that only now, after 5 weeks, had Hay's ultimatum at last been communicated to the Colombian Congress. It was construed by many as a threat of direct retaliation against Colombia in the event of non-ratification of the treaty. Delegates from the province of Panama were capitalizing on that threat and talking openly of secession. By a coincidence unsurprising to intimates of William Nelson Cromwell, the New York World prophesied the next morning that there would be a revolution in Panama on 3 November. Later in the day, a desperate message from Colombian liberals reached the State Department. The treaty might be saved if the United States would consent to two amendments, one requiring the Compagnie Nouvelle to pay a $10 million rights transferal fee, and the other increasing the zone's acquisition price from $10 million to $15 million. Hay prepared a note of refusal. "Make it as strong as you can to Beaupré," Roosevelt ordered him. "These contemptible little creatures in Bogota ought to understand how much they are jeopardizing things and imperiling their own future." The Kishinev petition finally wound its way up Sagamore Hill on 14 July. It was carried by Leo Levi and Simon Wolfe, who did not know what to make of the president's sudden urgency. Levi suppressed the cynical thought that Roosevelt might use a human tragedy in Bessarabia to shame the Tsar into opening up Manchuria. Wolfe was embarrassed at how few signatures they had been able to collect on such short notice. The names of individual Gentiles were especially elusive in the vacation season. Unavoidably, the list still looked like a Jewish petition rather than a mass interdenominational declaration. Oscar Solomon Strauss, a prominent Jew with diplomatic experience, and Albert Shaw, editor of Review of Reviews, joined the company for lunch in the president's paneled dining room. When Roosevelt heard that the petition bore only 2,000 or 3,000 signatures, he agreed that it was hardly worth submitting in physical form. Then he made an inspired suggestion. Secretary Hay should dispatch an official cable to Count Vladimir Lambsdorff, the Tsar's Minister of Foreign Affairs, inquiring whether or not an unofficial petition relating to the condition of the Jews in Russia would be acceptable to His Majesty. The cable would quote the entire text of the petition. Of course, Lambsdorff would say no, but he would have to file the cable as a formal message, while its senders published it around the world. Americans would have made their moral point, and Russians could not complain of any breach of diplomatic etiquette. Everyone approved of this idea. The president led the way to his library, adapted a previous draft prepared by Hay, and pinned the petition to it. Strauss, stoop-shouldered and frail, undertook to deliver the precious document to the State Department for immediate dispatch. Long before he got to Washington, the Russian embassy announced that certain cities in Manchuria were open to foreign commerce. This was less a coincidence, perhaps, than the consequence of Roosevelt's earlier blast against the Tsar's domestic and foreign policies. Evidently, Russia did, after all, worry about her inflexible world image. Hated by China, threatened by Japan and Japan's ally Britain, she did not need to add the United States to her list of enemies. Nicholas II's rejection of the petition cable the next day thus came as neither a disappointment nor a surprise. Roosevelt authorized the B'nai B'rith leaders to publicize the rejection as they chose, and accepted congratulations from John Hay. "You have done the right thing in the right way, and Jewry seems really grateful," the secretary wrote. An exuberant Roosevelt was less inclined to call the matter quits. "If only we were sure that neither France nor Germany would join in, I should not in the least mind going to extremes with Russia." The crescent self-confidence Edith Roosevelt had noticed after her husband's return from the West continued to energize him. He seemed to delight in juggling as many political and diplomatic balls as possible. To the annoyance of his children, carriages full of ponderous adults kept creaking through the chestnut trees. One such vehicle, on 15 July, discharged Treasury Secretary Leslie Shaw, Herman Kohlsatt of the Chicago Record-Herald, Charles J. Bonaparte, special counsel for the Justice Department in the post office investigation, and Ray Stannard Baker, reporter-at-large for McClure's. Baker's briefcase was especially bulky, with notes, maps, and memoranda. The president had asked him to substantiate charges of corruption in the Salt River Valley, Arizona reclamation project. A servant showed the visitors into the library. Roosevelt was nowhere to be seen. They sat for a while under the varnished gaze of Theodore Sr., absorbing an aura of well-handled books, oak and mahogany. On the desk, radiant with sun slanting in through gauze curtains, there lay a gold miner's pan, a silver dagger, and an inkwell ornamented with a little bust of Abraham Lincoln. Bearskins snarled silently on the floor. Somewhere a clock was ticking. It was well past noon. Like a sudden explosion, the president blew in through the door. He looked ruddy and healthy, in knickerbockers, worn gray shirt, and scuffed hiking shoes, and was bursting with mirth. In his hand he carried a note and newspaper clipping. "I want to read you something I have just got," he said. in connection with conditions in the South. He shot a gleeful glance at Bonaparte, who owned a Maryland plantation. The note was from Booker T. Washington. "My dear Mr. President, the enclosed is a true story." Roosevelt turned to the clipping from the Baltimore Herald. An old Florida colonel met Booker T. Washington, and in a bibulous burst of confidence, said to the Negro educator, "Sir, I'm glad to meet you. Always wanted to shake your hand, sir. I think, sir, you're the greatest man in America." "Oh, no," said Mr. Washington. "You are, sir," said the colonel, and then pugnaciously, "Who's greater?" "Well," said the founder of Tuskegee, "there's President Roosevelt." "No, sir," roared the colonel, "not by a jugful. I used to think so, but since he invited you to dinner, I think he's a," word omitted, "scoundrel." The library rang with presidential laughter. A gong sounded, and Roosevelt led the way into the dining room. Baker left a bemused account of the subsequent proceedings. It was a very simple lunch served by a maid. At first, the president talked postal affairs with Mr. Bonaparte, asserting over and over again that he wanted the investigation to be through. "I don't care who it hits," he said. "We must get to the bottom of these scandals." He then turned abruptly to me and said, "Baker, who is the chief devil down there in the Salt River Valley?" Since I had never considered the situation in terms of devils, I hesitated a moment, and the president burst into a vigorous, picturesque, and somewhat vitriolic description of the situation, implying that if he could catch the rascals who were causing the trouble, he would execute them on the spot. Several of the statements he made seemed to me to be inaccurate, or at least exaggerated, but when I tried to break into the conversation, boiling inside with my undelivered articles and memoranda, one of which, indeed, I tried to draw from my pocket, the president put one fist on the table beside him, looked at me earnestly, and said, "Baker, you and I will have to get together on these subjects." He instantly turned aside, leaving me, I think, with my mouth open, and began telling in a loud voice and with great unction of his lunch with a committee of prominent Jews interested in the Kishinev petition. He even imitated Oscar Strauss by a hitch of the shoulders, and laughed heartily when somebody asked if he had provided boiled ham for his guests. Once he said, "Do not all these things interest you? Isn't it a fine thing to be alive when so many great things are happening?" As the time drew near for leaving, I began to wonder when the president would ask me for the information upon which I had spent so much time and hard work. I had my heavy briefcase in hand when I went up to say goodbye, and my grand plans for enlightening the government of the United States vanished in a handshake. Mr. Bonaparte, Mr. Colsot, and I walked down together some 3 miles to Oyster Bay. I carried my heavy case, filled with my memoranda and papers and maps and pictures, and the sun was hot. Behind his jocularity on Southern race relations, the president was giving serious thought to an utterance on lynching. He admitted that long-term justice for the Negro concerned him more than any other issue. One of his least noticed guests that July was Rollo Ogden, sometime Presbyterian missionary, editor of the New York Evening Post, and a crusader against mob justice. They met amid reports that anti-Negro vigilantes were menacing a jail in Evansville, Indiana. Governor Winfield T. Durbin had sent in state troops, who killed 6 rioters. Even so, hundreds of terrified blacks were quitting town. The parallels to both the Wilmington lynching and the Kishinev pogrom were obvious. A cartoon in Literary Digest showed Nicholas II tearfully rejecting the B'nai B'rith petition. "Excuse me, I'm too busy weeping over this Delaware affair." Roosevelt promised Ogden that he would say something soon. For political reasons, he could not do so immediately. A Democratic primary campaign of extreme virulence was approaching its climax in Mississippi, with 2 racists, Hernando Money and James K. Vardaman, respectively fighting 2 administration-backed moderates for the senatorial and gubernatorial nominations. Since there was no effective Republican opposition in that state, selection was as good as election. Much invective was being lavished on the nigger-loving gang in Washington, particularly Roosevelt, for his support of Minnie Cox. Governor Andrew H. Longino, running for re-election, was blamed for involving the president in Mississippi politics during his 1902 visit to the Little Sunflower. Any move now by the detested Teddy against lynching, which Longino had himself condemned, would ensure the governor's defeat. So Roosevelt remained silent as midsummer heat mounted across the nation. The sun shone strong on western corn, ripening what looked to James Wilson's expert eye like bumper crops. A good harvest was gold in Republican coffers, the Secretary of Agriculture wrote from South Dakota. This people is very prosperous and so enthusiastic for you that they will contribute just as freely to next year's campaign as to build a church. Temperatures and tempers rose less encouragingly at labor conventions in many cities. So far in 1903, there had been a record 3,500 strikes nationwide, and not only Wall Street held Roosevelt responsible. In a severe blow to his popular image, the National Association of Letter Carriers endorsed William Randolph Hearst for president as a true friend of the plain people. Union after union berated Roosevelt for the low pay increase awarded the anthracite miners, and for his more recent precedent-setting enforcement of an open shop in the government printing office. James S. Clarkson, his chief patronage lieutenant outside Washington, grew nervous. He bombarded Sagamore Hill with statistics showing the alarming growth of the socialist vote in this country. Hearst, he wrote, was a real threat, with enough funds and newspapers, 300 at last count, to alienate every trade union from the Republican Party. He begged Roosevelt to avoid any further gestures toward free labor. This was not the right thing to say to a president who prided himself on being fair. Of course I will not for one moment submit to dictation by the labor unions any more than by the trusts, Roosevelt shot back. And that, no matter what the effect on the presidential election may be. Three times in one sentence, he reminded Clarkson that he stood for a square deal. The sun beat down ever more fiercely, turning southern plantations white, western farms gold, northern fields yellow and silver. It bleached the pale Percherons, working Roosevelt's own 47 acres. Farmers everywhere looked forward to an autumn bounty. But in the shadowed enclave of Wall Street, bears prowled. On 22 July, Jefferson Seligman, a banker friend, came out to see the president, warning of an imminent financial panic. Roosevelt had never understood the ebb and flow of money through his own hands or anyone else's. Every morning, Edie puts $20 in my pocket, and to save my life, I can never tell her afterward what I did with it. So he listened with more patience than comprehension as Seligman expounded the need for currency reform legislation. The problem apparently was an inelastic currency, combined with a seasonal need for cash to move America's crops to market. Toward the end of the summer, demand greater than supply caused cash to flow from Wall Street banks to the rural heartland, leaving behind depleted vaults and falling stock prices. Late in the fall, the money began to flow back, but promoters, stock jobbers, and other speculators trembled while it was gone, lest banks call their loans. This summer, the risk looked greater than usual. Continued combination and overcapitalization, not to mention worry over the Northern Securities Company's appeal to the Supreme Court, had created a vast surplus of vulnerable stocks. Undigested securities, J.P. Morgan called them. Roosevelt referred Seligman to Leslie Shaw, who had an emergency plan to transfer government gold into the national reserves. Then he braced for the strong views his next guest was bound to have on any such corrective measure. Joseph G. Cannon famously knew more about finance than anybody else in Congress, even Senator Aldrich. A profound conservative of the Midwestern small-town variety, Cannon was unlikely to be disturbed by the current situation. Eastern trust lords had been too grandiose in their capitalizations. They needed a short, sharp slump, affecting millionaires primarily, to teach them fiscal responsibility. "Uncle Joe wants no legislation," Roosevelt dictated to his secretary while waiting for Cannon to arrive. "It seems to me we ought to have some." When the speaker climbed out of his carriage, it was clear he was playing the defiant hayseed. He wore a seersucker jacket with tails that floated on the breeze, and salt-and-pepper trousers ballooned round his bony legs. The accepted uniform for waiting on the president was a dark frock coat, irrespective of season, but Cannon declined to apologize for his appearance. "It was too damn hot," he said. Cannon's rumpled appearance, his scraggy white beard, perpetual half-chewed cigar, and folksy profanities were all part of a calculated image to disguise one of the most disciplined forces in government. Close inspection revealed his clothes to be of fine quality. A daily fresh pink in his lapel suggested the private dandy. While the beard was kept short and the cigar, when puffed, gave off mellow evidence of Havana leaf. As for the profanities, they were carefully mild. Cannon was actually more at home quoting Shakespeare and the Bible, which he studied every day, along with the Congressional Record. His wire puppet jerkiness was caused by an unusually fast reflex system, mental and physical. Not even Roosevelt was quicker to react to the occasional signals of intent or flexibility that politicians flash in conversation. And back of the quickness was an instant obstinacy whenever any tenet of orthodox republicanism was threatened. The thin grin would vanish, the blue stare freeze, the long bony forefinger tap with suppressed fury. He was, in the president's not unaffectionate opinion, a hard, narrow old Boeotian. After a two-hour lunch, officially described as social, Cannon left Sagamore Hill smiling, hinting that he might consider some currency reform in a future session. But when he stopped off in New York, en route to his home in Illinois, he showed no inclination to reassure Wall Street further on that score. "I could not get him to visit a single banker," Congressman Lucius Litauer wrote Roosevelt. His constant reiteration was that a time of financial panic was not one in which to discuss the necessity of financial legislation. No sooner had Cannon left town on 23 July than a serious collapse in share values began on Wall Street. Banks canceled credit, and syndicates unloaded their reserve investments of high-grade securities. U.S. Steel Common dropped by more than 50%. Frantic for more funds, the syndicates put up their newer, underwritten offerings and got almost nothing for them. J.P. Morgan's United States Shipbuilding Company went bankrupt, as did the $100 million Consolidated Lake Superior. Four major brokers went out of business. Like ripples round a dropped stone, waves of desperation ringed outward, but shallowly, failing to shake the calm depths of general investment. Cannon had gotten, perhaps even brought on, the rich man's panic he wanted. Secretary Shaw wrote to reassure Roosevelt, as did James Clarkson. "The country is prosperous every place else except Wall Street, and perhaps the street is all the better for this experience." So while stockbrokers raged, blaming the administration's antitrust policies, "This is a market on which John D. Rockefeller could not borrow on Standard Oil," Roosevelt kept cool in white flannels. He had discovered a new sport, cricket, and spent many hours with a British professional, learning the difference between top spins, long hops, and silly mid-ons. 1,000 miles south, the white Democrats of Mississippi prepared to cast their primary votes for governor and senator. James K. Vardaman's vicious rhetoric had somehow turned the contest into one between Rooseveltism and racism. On 9 August, the president decided to issue his long-delayed utterance in the form of a public letter to Winfield T. Durbin of Indiana. "My dear Governor Durbin," he wrote, "permit me to thank you as an American citizen for the admirable way in which you have vindicated the majesty of the law by your recent action in reference to lynching." Durbin had not only dispelled rioters with troops, but proclaimed the right of a black murderer to a fair trial. "All thoughtful men," Roosevelt continued, "must feel the gravest alarm over the growth of lynching in this country, and especially over the peculiarly hideous forms so often taken by mob violence when colored men are the victims, on which occasions the mob seems to lay most weight not on the crime, but on the color of the criminal. In a minority of cases, fewer than one in four, lynch victims were guilty of rape, a crime horrible beyond description. Yet rape's very bestiality required that society respond to it in a civilized fashion. Roosevelt was at his most impassioned when he commented on the sadistic quality of lynchings. "There are certain hideous sights which, when once seen, can never be wholly erased from the mental retina. The mere fact of having seen them implies degradation. Whoever in any part of our country has ever taken part in lawlessly putting to death a criminal by the dreadful torture of fire must forever after have the awful spectacle of his own handiwork seared into his brain and soul. He can never again be the same man." Rollo Ogden congratulated him after the letter was published. "One of your happiest inspirations in the public service." Other liberal-minded editors praised the strength, if not the promptness, of the president's statement. They did not see how delaying it had improved Mississippi's political situation, where Vardaman and Hernando Money both won decisively. Roosevelt concluded that for the time being he had done all he could, rhetorically and practically, to help the American Negro. He would not risk his political future by seeming to endorse, in Vardaman's phrase, "the black wave of ignorance, superstition, and immorality with which the South is perpetually threatened." By now the State Department was seriously concerned over Arthur Beaupré's silence. The minister to Columbia was notorious for the frequency and verbosity of his cables. 3 wordless weeks had given the impression he had been garroted. On 12 August, however, $1,000 worth of prose suddenly came over the wire. Beaupré summarized no fewer than 9 amendments that had been attached to the Panama Canal Treaty in committee. The Colombian Senate now proposed at least $5 million more in cash, plus huge kickbacks from the Compagnie Nouvelle and the Panama Railroad. The United States would be granted tenancy only in the canal zone and would have to endure Colombian standards of law enforcement and sanitation. Beaupré begged John Hay, who was back in New Hampshire, for an emphatic statement or instructions before the amendments were adopted by the Colombian Senate. Hay was enraged. He had sent at least 2 sets of instructions over the past month, making plain that the United States would accept no amendments whatever. Evidently, Beaupré had not received them. Columbia's cable service, Hay noticed, malfunctioned with curious regularity whenever the text of the treaty was undergoing serious scrutiny. Now there arrived at Sagamore Hill a letter written by a longtime American resident of Bogota. It described anti-treaty sentiment in the capital as increasingly raucous and bitter. Politicians, merchants, planters, and common citizens were complaining that the United States wanted them to make a sacrifice of untold millions belonging by right to their children. One agitator was quoted as excoriating the "dirty American pigs" already wallowing in Panama mud. Neither Roosevelt nor Hay had any public comment or prediction. "I am totally in the dark as to what the outcome in the isthmus will be," the president told Senator Morgan. The first indication that he was losing patience came on Friday, 14 August, when Shelby M. Cullom, chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, emerged from a lunchtime conference at Sagamore Hill. Speaking with obvious authority, Cullom told reporters that no matter what happened in Bogota, the administration remained committed to a Panama Canal. Question: how can the canal be built without the treaty? Answer: well, we might make another treaty, not with Colombia, but with Panama. Question: but Panama is not a sovereign state. Answer: intimations have been made that there is great discontent on the isthmus over the action of the Congress of the central government, and Panama might break away and set up a government which we could treat with. Question: is the U.S. prepared to encourage such a schism in a South American republic? Answer: no, I suppose not, but this country wants to build that canal, and build it now. Whatever action Cullum was referring to, or anticipating, he could not have more clearly signaled Senate support for any executive powers Roosevelt might avail himself of in the near future. That weekend, an extraordinary naval panoply spread across Long Island Sound. 22 white warships could be seen lying in parallel rows off the entrance to Oyster Bay, a spectacle, in the eyes of one observer, almost overwhelmingly suggestive of America's newly born sea power. Monday dawned, bright and mirror calm. The sun picked out thousands of white-clad sailors, stationing themselves in geometric shapes, on decks and in rigging. Oyster Bay bristled with pleasure boats, come to witness the president's review of the fleet. Roosevelt came down from Sagamore Hill after breakfast and boarded the USS Mayflower. 9.5 hours later, he returned home, eyes bloodshot from the glare of white metal and water, buffeted by the roar of continuous 21-gun salutes, 63,000 rounds in all. Hanging smoke thickened the dusk as he walked through the woods. An urgent cable from Beaupré awaited him. Bogota, August 12, 7 p.m. The treaty was rejected by the Senate today in its entirety. Roosevelt was still digesting this news. We may have to give a lesson to those jackrabbits. When a note arrived from John Hay, the secretary, who had never been a Panama enthusiast, reminded him that he could now revert to the simple and easy Nicaraguan solution, rather than press ahead with the far more difficult and multifurcate scheme articulated by Senator Cullum. Before replying, Roosevelt studied the text of a startlingly aggressive memorandum by John Bassett Moore, the reigning American authority on international law. It had been forwarded to him by Francis B. Loomis, who was fast becoming his preferred contact at the State Department. Professor Moore's memorandum argued that Panama was the only place in the Americas to build a canal for the world. The question of Colombian sovereignty was therefore a global rather than a regional one. All nations had a right to benefit from the opening of this great gate of intercourse between East and West.